This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 14th of March, these are our main stories. Beijing warns against a new security pact between the US, Britain and Australia to counter Chinese influence in the Pacific. Tourists are allowed back into China for the first time since COVID struck. Colombian drug criminals are accused by the president of violating the hard-won ceasefire. Also in this podcast, India's Supreme Court rejects the government's call to reopen the issue of compensation for victims of the world's worst industrial disaster.
He took off his glasses and his eyes were swollen and red. And he said, just go inside and shut the doors. It was like somebody had burnt a mountain of chilies. The eyes, they were burning.
And riding motorbikes could become a whole lot harder for tourists in Bali. Russia has joined China and criticised yesterday's security deal between the US and UK to supply nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. Beijing has described the move as embarking on a path of error and danger. The security pact, known as the AUKUS agreement, is aimed at countering China's influence in the Asia-Pacific region with a new fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Moscow claims the submarine pact would bring years of confrontation to Asia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin had this warning.
The US, the UK and Australia have gone further and further down a wrong and dangerous road for their own selfish political gains. This involves nuclear-armed countries transferring a large amount of highly enriched weapons-grade uranium to a non-nuclear weapon country, posing a severe risk in nuclear proliferation.
Our security correspondent Frank Gardner told me more.
This is probably the moment of highest diplomatic and rhetorical tension between China and the West since Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan last summer. If you remember, that was followed by a series of very aggressive, very provocative military exercises by China in which it essentially encircled Taiwan and gave it a foretaste of what it might expect in the future. China is bizarrely certainly making out that it's feeling encircled by the US and its allies. But of course, this is a product of some of its own actions because it has effectively colonized parts of the South China Sea. It's taken over atolls that are claimed by other nations, the Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam. And in some cases, it's even turned them into static aircraft launch pads and said that other countries need permission to sail past them when it's declared under international law that this is open sea. Then, of course, there is the constant threat by China to, as they call it, reunify with Taiwan. I was in Taiwan recently, and they say reunification is not the right word. We were never unified with the People's Republic of China. You know, we are self-governing. It's things like that which are creating a lot of tension here. But, of course, against the backdrop of all of this, you've got the Ukraine war. And the big question is China going to send weapons to Russia? Because Russia's running out of weapons, China's got an awful lot of them. So this is probably not good for the West and Ukraine in terms of the Ukraine war, because there is a risk here that the angrier that China gets with the West, and by the West I mean, in this case, the AUKUS trio, United States, Australia and UK, the more it may be tempted to cozy up to and help President Putin out of the mess he's got himself into in Ukraine.
Yes, because it is the question of whether this is a bipolar or a tripolar world now.
Yes, I mean, I think tripolar is probably the most accurate in the sense that you've got one sort of power centre coalescing around China and Russia's leadership, and you've got a number of countries like Belarus, Eritrea, Venezuela, Iran, and North Korea that have sort of tend to be in that camp. It's not a formal arrangement. It's certainly not a Warsaw Pact, but it's starting to coalesce. And then you've got NATO, of course, but you've got the US-led group that now includes Japan, the Philippines, South Korea, and Taiwan, which is allowing China to feel threatened. Now, the idea of these submarines that are going to take ages to build, by the way, these AUKUS-class submarines, they won't be delivered until the 2030s. In the meantime, the US is probably going to lend Australia three of its Virginia-class subs. Australia doesn't have currently any long-range nuclear submarines. And by nuclear, I mean nuclear-powered, not nuclear-armed. And this is a really important distinction because China is saying that this is going to increase proliferation in the region. But these aren't carrying nuclear missiles. What they are doing is they are mobile intelligence centers that can float around underwater and detect things, which China, of course, doesn't like that because China considers that the Western Pacific and indeed even parts of the Indo-Pacific are very much its sphere and that this is an awful long way away from the United States and NATO countries and they have no business being there. China is a great one for saying non-interference. And it considers that Taiwan is a domestic internal matter that has nothing to do with any other country. And they totally reject the idea of US or anybody else coming to the defense of Taiwan.
Briefly, it's only a few submarines. China's military is massive. Is it really going to make any difference?
Potentially, yes. You're absolutely right. China's military, it is massive. Most of it is outdated, but they are on a massive rearmament program, particularly to treble the number of ballistic nuclear missiles they've got. And by that, I do mean nuclear-armed thermonuclear weapons. No, China is absolutely set on becoming the premier world power by 2049, which is the centenary of the foundation of communist China. So it's not going to, I think, stop them in that ambition, but it's an annoying road bump for them.
Frank Gardner. After more than a year of war, much of Ukraine's infrastructure has been destroyed, leaving many people struggling without food, medicines and power. In the Kherson region in the south, a group of volunteers have been trying to help, delivering basic supplies to hundreds of local residents several times a month. This work takes them within range of Russian troops, which, as a BBC team witnessed, frequently puts their lives at risk. Victoria Zuhai reports.
A former gymnasium turned distribution center, stacked full of groceries and essential household items, from soap to toilet paper. Some Ukrainian volunteers build a human chain, filling up small vans outside. They are working concentrated and at speed. A constant threat is hanging in the air. This warehouse is located in South Ukraine, between Zaporizhia and Kherson, and within the range of Russian artillery fire. Once a few vans are fully loaded, they set off in a convoy to deliver the goods to remote villages, facing multiple threats along the road. Serhii is one of the volunteers on board.
In Marganets, it is difficult and intense, but in the area where we are headed to, people were under a very difficult occupation and went through so much misery.
As soon as the convoy leaves town, it becomes visible to the Russian military. Shelling can happen anytime, and it's not long before they receive reports of artillery fire close by. Serhii arrives in a small village which hadn't seen any aid in over 3 weeks. The vehicles get quickly surrounded by a happy but exhausted-looking crowd of people. For many here, this is the only source of food. Volunteer Kostya starts recording a video when suddenly this happens. A shell exploded just a couple of hundred meters away. Minutes later, a second shell explodes, this time much closer. Our BBC team decides to evacuate. We are being targeted by incoming fire from Russian positions. We are driving off. And volunteer Kostya is still recording and narrating what had just happened.
We are leaving Milove. There was an artillery attack just now. It was so strong. I've never heard anything like it.
The Ukrainian authorities later tell me that nobody was killed in that specific attack. Meanwhile, Kostya, Serhii and the other volunteers continue to deliver aid to the next village.
Victoria Zuhai. The Bhopal gas leak in India in 1984 is widely considered to have been one of the world's worst industrial catastrophes. Campaigners say around 25,000 people died and up to 500,000 survivors suffered respiratory problems. One of those survivors was Farah Edwards Khan, who was 10 years old at the time. She recalled what happened in a BBC interview in 2012.
It was about 1:32 in the night and we were fast asleep, and there was a banging on the door and my cousin was standing outside. It was the middle of the night, but he was wearing dark glasses and he took off his glasses and his eyes were swollen and red. And we said, "What's happened?" He said, "Just go inside and shut the doors. There's been a terrible gas accident." It was like somebody had burnt chilies in a warehouse, a mountain of chilies. The eyes, they were burning.
Now, India's Supreme Court has rejected a government plea for further compensation for the victims. It said there was no reason to dig up the issue again more than three decades after the initial settlement, when Union Carbide paid out $470 million in damages without admitting any responsibility. Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, told us more.
One of the arguments put by the Supreme Court was that this was settled in 1989 between the Government of India and Union Carbide, which is now owned by Dow Chemicals, out-of-court settlement of $470 million. And what is the point in revisiting this particular settlement 30 years later? And the government should have argued if there had been any claim of fraud or any other issue with the settlement, then they could have considered, but the government did not argue on that point. The main argument was that it was not enough. It was a paltry sum and people are still suffering. So they were asking for about $1.1 billion. So on technical grounds, the Supreme Court said there was no rationale in bringing this up after a clear settlement was announced.
Because the company behind this never admitted responsibility, did it?
It was a huge controversy at that time. As you said, it was the worst industrial accident at that time. I still remember in the 1980s, we were all watching these black and white photographs and black and white television at that time, before the advent of the colour television. The grim pictures emerging after Bhopal and thousands of people dying at that time. And then the Union Carbide always argued that it was managed by the Indian subsidiary and they never took any responsibility. In fact, many of those executives who were imprisoned, when a long drawn court cases were all Indian executives. And so this out-of-court settlement did not satisfy many activists and also people who are still suffering. You know, the waste still lying there, you know, it's not been cleaned properly. People are still having health issues. And that's why people said the sum was like, for example, $2,200 per person for family, which was nothing because people lost their family, their belongings and all the relatives. So that is why there was a lot of pressure on the government to revisit this case. But the Union Carbide, you know, always maintained that it was an Indian subsidiary. And in fact, you know, once they merged or it was bought by Dow Chemicals, Dow Chemicals did not take any of the liabilities.
So briefly, where does this go next?
Now it is for the activists to put pressure on the government. In fact, the Supreme Court also said the Indian government can dip into their own pockets to give more compensation to the victims. But still, the legacy of this tragedy is there. People are still suffering in the city of Bhopal.
Anbarasan Etirajan. The Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, has accused the country's largest drug trafficking cartel, Clan del Golfo, of breaking a ceasefire agreement by supporting attacks by illegal gold miners. On Sunday, miners destroyed an aqueduct in the northwest of the country. I heard more from our reporter, Mimi Swabi.
The Clan del Golfo is the biggest cartel in Colombia. It's thought to be made up of around 6,000 members who are battling rival gangs, paramilitary groups, and also the Colombian authorities to kind of keep their stronghold in northwestern Colombia. This is a very lucrative drug trafficking point in the country, but also a big mining area. So this is how the cartel have really got into the seams of society and have control over the area, is within that mining community.
And Colombia has been racked by civil war for decades. It had looked so close. It looked as though maybe the end was in sight. How did this ceasefire come about and why is it going wrong?
You're right. This was a really exciting moment last year when Gustavo Petro took presidency. He was a former guerrilla member himself. He was part of the M19 group. And his whole campaign was centred around bringing peace to the country, who had so much bloodshed, so much pain, that people were really looking to him as a figure of hope. And he started negotiation talks with criminal organisations, many rebel groups, including FARC and ELN. But he hasn't quite managed to get this cartel under control. This ceasefire was agreed in December, but as you said, a ambulance, a toll and an aqueduct has been destroyed through the miners. It's thought that the cartel will have been paying the miners to pass off the violence as a social strike. But Gustavo tweeted that affecting a town's water and putting the lives of boys and girls and humans at risk, the clan's hostility towards the population, that has broken the ceasefire. It isn't actually the actions, it's the intent at the public which has really crossed the line in Gustavo Petro's opinion.
Given that all the other rebel groups pretty much have come on side, how is the Clan del Golfo able to stand up, and why aren't the others putting pressure on them?
Only at the weekend, second round of peace talks with ELN seemed very hopeful. Like you said, this is moving in the right direction in many aspects, but this cartel is very separate from rebel criminal groups. This is a drug cartel, a gang, and they are extremely powerful. They are extremely wealthy. Colombia earns nearly more in illegal mining than it does in trafficking cocaine. So this is a hugely powerful and hugely lucrative industry. They are very separate, and Colombia is a big country, and each territory is often aided by geography as well. It's next to the Panama border, their area, their turf. So it is easy to get in and out. The links are very helpful for them in this situation.
Mimi Swabi. When two massive earthquakes struck Turkey and Syria last month, killing more than 50,000 people, it didn't take long for questions to be asked as to why so many buildings had collapsed. Now, a team of engineers from the UK has travelled to Turkey to try to find the answer. The group has carried out assessments of major earthquakes over the last three decades. More from our science editor, Rebecca Morell.
The team of leading experts from academia and industry will carefully assess a whole range of buildings in Turkey. They're visiting cities and rural areas to build up a full picture of what happened when the earthquake struck. Work with their colleagues in Turkey has already revealed some examples of poor construction. They've found large pebbles taken from riverbeds that have been mixed into concrete, which weakens its strength. They've also discovered steel reinforcements that are of substandard quality. But the team believes the size and nature of the earthquake also played a part in the devastation. The ground movement in some areas was so great it exceeded what some earthquake-resilient buildings had been designed to withstand. Professor Emily So from Cambridge University is co-leader of the investigation.
It's important to get the full picture rather than just looking at a snapshot of a single asset or a single building, because the successes of the ones that are still intact and perform perfectly well is as important as its neighbours that have collapsed. And actually having that distribution, having that overview is really key to what we do and what we can learn from this earthquake.
The engineers will report their findings in a matter of weeks and hope that they can inform how buildings are reconstructed in the years ahead.
Rebecca Morell. Coming up, spinning great apes.
We found that great apes were spinning as fast as Sufi whirling dervishes, which is a tradition where individuals spin with the specific purpose of entering a trance-like state.
China says it will resume issuing visas to foreign travellers on Wednesday in a major easing of pandemic restrictions. The country welcomed more than 65 million tourists in 2019 and is eager to reignite its languishing tourism sector. Stephen McDonnell is in Beijing.
For more than 3 years, foreign tourists have not been able to enter China, in stark contrast to the tens of millions of international travellers who are coming here every year prior to the coronavirus outbreak. Now China's foreign ministry has announced that from tomorrow, tourist visas will again be issued. The removal of the last cross-border restrictions imposed to tackle COVID marks a major step towards the resumption of normal life in post-pandemic China.
Stephen McDonnell. Another country which lost tourists to COVID is Indonesia. They've been returning to the island of Bali, but the local governor isn't happy with some of the visitors. He's planning to clamp down on foreigners riding motorbikes. This follows an increase in cases of people breaking local traffic laws. Olivia Noon has more.
From late February to early March, more than 170 foreign nationals violated traffic orders on the island. The local governor said that tourists were often riding without helmets, T-shirts and a driver's licence. Motorbikes are a popular mode of transport for tourists, with the rental bikes providing travellers with easy access around the island, which doesn't have a well-developed public transport system. Tourists use the bikes to weave through traffic and travel through back alleys. This Russian tourist had been riding without a helmet.
I came here today without a helmet, right? I figured that I was close, and you can ride without a helmet. I understood that I was violating local laws, but some kind of situation here could be like that. And why am I doing all this, which obviously is definitely wrong? And maybe after this interview, I will always wear a helmet here. But nevertheless, I personally find myself at ease.
It's now been proposed that tourists will have to use vehicles provided by travel agents instead. The new proposal is likely to come into force later this year, but it's divided opinion on the island, which is still recovering from financial losses because of COVID. The chair of Bali's Motorbike Rental Association said the plans were hasty and that the authorities should act on specific violations rather than setting a blanket ban. But the governor says, if you're a tourist, then act like one and use vehicles provided by travel agencies.
Olivia Noon. A Japanese MP is to be stripped of his status as a lawmaker after failing to attend any parliamentary sessions since his election last year. Yoshikazu Higashitani, who also goes by the name of Gashi, is famous for his videos on YouTube. In a recent video, he appears to be in Turkey speaking to children affected by the earthquake.
Hi there. Ah, nice to meet you. My name is Gashi. Gashi.
Our Tokyo correspondent is Shaima Khalil.
A member of parliament who is not in parliament, Alex. Yoshikazu Higashitani, as you heard there, he's known as Gashi on YouTube. He's a famous celebrity gossip YouTuber that's turned MP. He was elected to the upper house in July last year, and he has not attended one single session in parliament since the day he was elected. He was given many warnings, a last chance, but I think he's angered enough people in the chamber that they unanimously have voted to expel him. And I think he's the first lawmaker in Japan to actually be kicked out of parliament without actually setting foot in parliament.
So what has he been doing? We heard that clip of him in Turkey there.
That's right. He's believed to live in the United Arab Emirates. He was actually expected here in Japan on March 8th, so last week, to come to Parliament in person and apologize himself. This was demanded by the chamber as a last chance, if you will, or also a form of punishment, that you come and you apologize to a plenary session. He said on YouTube that he would actually come, but again, no-show. This is another name for him now, the no-show MP. And that has angered the upper house even further. So now he is to be expelled. They're going to finalize that later this week. I think in the history of Japan, first of all, this is the most strict form of punishment for a lawmaker, and it only happened twice since 1950. But this is the first time it is applied to an MP for failing to attend, for the lack of attendance.
Briefly, how are people in Japan responding?
This has been going on for a while, and I think, again, he's kind of been famous for not being there. But one of the other members of his party, Hamada Satoshi, has actually addressed the upper house and said it was illegal to expel Mr. Higashitani. But it looks like this is going to be confirmed, and he is going to be stripped of his title.
Shaima Khalil. To Kenya now, where people are questioning a controversial new policy which will see thousands of bars and restaurants shut down. The action comes in a bid to curb what the government sees as a major alcohol and drug abuse problem. It's announced that in central Kenya, only one bar will be allowed to operate in each town, as Emmanuel Igunza reports.
Central Kenya is battling what the government wants is an alcohol and drugs epidemic. Authorities blame it on the high number of unregulated bars and pubs and an influx of cheap illicit brews. That's why Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua has announced a new directive.
We want to appeal to our governors to sit down and agree that they cannot license each and every outlet to be bar and restaurant to sell 24 hours. It is wrong, it is unacceptable. That in pursuit of revenue, licensing every kiosk, every outlet to be bar and restaurant, you want to destroy an entire generation.
And the government has been widely supported by residents here in central Kenya. In the next county of Murang'a, I meet 58-year-old Rosemary Kimani. She works as a community health worker and says she lost her husband to alcoholism while three of her children are all battling dependency.
Parents have spent fortunes to educate these young men, but the only work they do is wake up in the morning and go to drink. You can't find these men even with girlfriends, as all their energy is for Changa, the local illicit brew. They don't have time for family. Are we really going to see a new generation?
Under the new directive, only one bar will be licensed per town. Premises will also be required to strictly sell alcohol between 5 p.m. and midnight. But business owners say this will lead to the closure of hundreds of legitimate bars and restaurants and entertainment spots and cause massive job losses. They want the government to deal with the actual problem, which they say is illicit brews. Simon Mwangi is the chairman of the Kenya Bar and Hotel Association.
When they talked about one club in one town, especially Mount Kenya, let us call a spade, you'll be closing 17,000 businesses in the central region. You're talking about one bar, but have you really talked about the product? Let us now differentiate things. What are people drinking in Kenya? Not about the bars. How many bars are there? That's another, but what are the products are these bars selling? That is the way, that should be the conversation.
Local NGOs and the church have intervened to try and set up rehabilitation centers, but they are expensive and out of reach for many addicts. Attitudes here have also made it harder, with many young people saying alcohol and drug abuse are not the major problem in central Kenya. There's currently no exact data as to just how many people are affected by alcohol abuse here in central Kenya, but experts warn that an entire generation could be lost here if nothing is done to tackle the crisis.
Emmanuel Igunza. Finally, to a story that may get your head spinning. A new study has found that great apes deliberately spin around in order to make themselves dizzy. Dr. Adriano Lemera is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Warwick in the UK, who co-led the study. My colleague Rob Young first asked him why he decided to study this.
It was such a conspicuous behavior. Once you see it, it's difficult to forget it. And I've lived many years in the jungles of Indonesia following wild orangutans. And so when I was back at the university, trawling through the YouTube and came across these videos, it was just remarkable. It differed from the natural behavior and at the same time looked so much like things that we all know and have experienced and have fun with.
So what is it you think they are trying to do?
What our approach was to see how fast they were spinning, how many revolutions they were achieving per second, because they were clearly falling onto the ground dizzy on the floor afterwards. And so, of course, the behavior as we know it has very little to no obvious utility at all. And so it was really, it really indicated that to us that great apes were indeed purposely seeking this head rush and brief sense of elation.
So they're just having fun.
To really, exactly. Yeah. In a way, yes. I mean, at least as a projection of our own experience. And so to confirm the intriguing possibility that they were, as well as we do, seeking this rush, we compared the spinning speeds of great apes with human world traditions that involve spinning, from ballet and other dance pirouettes to circus acts on suspended ropes. And what we found was that in this recreational way, great apes were achieving spinning speeds as fast as some of the best professional human performers who must go through dedicated and intense training to prevent the nauseating effects of spinning. And indeed, we found that great apes were spinning as fast as Sufi whirling dervishes, which is a tradition where individuals spin with the specific purpose of entering a trance-like state. And so, you know, it confirmed to us, it was a non-invasive way of confirming that great apes are also probably self-inducing similar effects, just momentarily.
Psychology professor Dr. Adriano Lemera. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.